friends, welcome back to No More Silos. Thanks so much for joining me. I am super excited that you're still listening to this podcast on cultural Christianity. This is season 2, episode 4, and my name is Erica Santiago. I am hopeful that you are, if you're not already, going to follow me on social media at Instagram or on Facebook at Cultural Christianity. If you have questions for episode ideas or comments or questions about anything that I've talked about in any of the episodes, you can send me an email to podcast@ericasantiago.com. Last week, we started a conversation about the value of history, that, you know, history matters, and how, because oftentimes we lack context or we're not sure where to go and get information, that from a cultural Christianity standpoint, we allow silos of historical information to persist. And so we are missing the opportunities to connect the dots. And that is affecting our ability to disciple others. So if you are a follower of Christ and you believe in the mandate of Jesus and the Great Commission to go and make disciples, that means to teach others. And Jesus goes on to say in Matthew 28 that we're supposed to teach his commands. Well, what were Jesus's commands and how did he disciple folks? And so we're looking at that in this season. And the books that we're reading that I've recommended in earlier episodes include Emotionally Healthy Discipleship by Pete Scazzaro, Urban Apologetics by Eric Mason, and today we're going to talk about The Making of Biblical Womanhood by Beth Barr. I had, I guess, a pipe dream of thinking I was going to get to Beth Barr's book in our last episode, but I looked up and realized I had been talking for about 40 minutes or so, and so at this point, I haven't even edited that episode yet, so it hopefully will be less than 40 minutes when it gets published, but that said, this is kind of part two to that conversation, the value of history, putting context in behind what we understand to be Christian history and why it's so important. And so last week we started a conversation really stemming out of Genesis 1, that God made us in his image. And that because we are made in his image, our identity and value, our identity is in Christ, but our value didn't start at justification. It starts at creation. That means that whether you are a Christian or not, whether you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ or not, whether you believe that Jesus died for your sins and my sins, and that we are reconciled back to God or not, you still have inherent value. You have value as a person because God made you. Heck, even if you don't even believe in God, if you believe the universe made you, you have inherent value. We all do. It starts at creation, whatever you believe creation to be. But as a follower of Jesus, I believe that creation starts with God, that God, through intelligent design, created the heavens and the earth. And so I believe what it says in Genesis. And so I'm going with that and I'm running with it. So my identity in Christ, because I am a follower of Jesus, I believe that and affirm that, that part of my value, that part of my identity. Our ethnic value, Dr. Mason says, doesn't change in salvation, but it's given redemptive clarity as it is brought under the cross. And so that's one of the things that we ended with in the last episode. Looking at the first couple of chapters in Urban Apologetics, and again, my goal here is to, in this season, to help you and myself, because I'm kind of walking through a lot of this as I'm talking about it, to use these resources to disciple others. To be in a better position to talk through and teach what it is Jesus commanded in a better context, a context that considers the history, not just what happened in the last 50 years, but the history going back 2,000 years. I mean, honestly, we'll get to that. Let's talk about a further exploration of dignity. Remember, we're getting that out of Genesis chapter 1. But a few years ago, maybe it was 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I did a Bible study for our church on all the women in the New Testament, not just in the Bible, because most of us know about Ruth and Rahab and Sarah and so forth. But a lot of us are not familiar with all the women that are in the New Testament, because sometimes we just have their names. Sometimes they show up at the end of a story of or an account in the New Testament. And so we're not really sure what to do with those people. And we're not really sure what the biblical tradition or historical traditions are around those people. And so we explored that. And in that, I came across a few different quotes that I'll share with you right now. One is from someone named James Hurley, and he said, "The most striking thing about the role of women in the life and teaching of Jesus is the simple fact that they are there. Although the gospel texts contain no special sayings repudiating the view of the day about women, their uniform testimony to the presence of women among the followers of Jesus and to his serious teaching of them constitutes a break with tradition, which has been described as being without precedent in what was then contemporary Judaism." It's a big deal. Another writer says, "Jesus treated women with dignity and respect, and he elevated them in a world where they were often mistreated." And goes on to talk about how Jesus did not perceive women primarily in terms of their sex, their age, or marital status. He seems to have considered them in terms of their relation, or lack thereof, to God. I was reading something recently that talked about how in the Old Testament, women were described often based on their beauty, their outward appearance, more often than not. But in the New Testament, we don't get that. We don't hear about how beautiful Mary was or what Mary Magdalene looked like. What we hear about or what we read about in the New Testament is their character, their faith, and their relationship to God. And why is that important? Because that's the gospel message, that we are reconciled through Christ's death and resurrection to God, to that Genesis 1, God made us in his image, the dignity that comes from that. Another writer says, "Jesus's honor and respect was extended to all women, an attitude largely unexpected and unknown in his culture and time. Jesus, unlike the men of his generation and culture, taught that women were equal to men in the sight of God. Women could receive God's forgiveness and grace. Women, as well as men, could be among Christ's personal followers. Women could be full participants in the kingdom of God. They were revolutionary, or these were revolutionary ideas." Many of his contemporaries, including his disciples, were shocked. And we see that shock in Jesus's encounter with the Canaanite woman, in his encounter with the woman with the issue of blood. And what's interesting, if you're reading the Gospels, and if you take some time this summer, and just I encourage you just to read through the Gospels, you'll notice that some of the Gospel writers develop a pattern of telling an encounter with a man, and then an encounter with a woman, then an encounter with a man, then an encounter with a woman. And so by the time we get to Paul sharing about Christian living with the church at Galatia, and he says, there is neither slave nor free, nor man nor woman. Hello, the idea is that it doesn't matter because God made us in his image. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. And I think that a lot of times what happens in because of patriarchy in the church is we only hear the stories about the women that were problematic. Like I can't tell you how many sermons I've heard on the adulterous woman. We mishmash the characters of Mary Magdalene with others from the Bible when there's really no evidence that you can lump all these women together, because sometimes they went unnamed. We don't have all of their names. Anyway, history matters. That's what we've been talking about here on No More Silos today. History matters because it affects how we interpret the Bible and how we determine if a passage is based in culture or in creation. How did previous generations interpret this passage, and why did they interpret it that way? What circumstances caused them to see it that way? A good example of not going back far enough is how some in our culture have created this war, this so-called war, this culture of war, actually. Many of us are not old enough to remember life during the last pandemic, so we were scrambling last year trying to figure things out. And many of us are not old enough to remember life before the so-called culture war with the church that is a big focus in the mainstream media. And so one of the things that that I was excited about with Beth Barr's book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, subtitled How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth. One of the things I was excited about that is just the history, because we are following, I'm following a 2,000 plus year old religion, right? That's what I'm following. I'm following Jesus, and this is what I believe, and it goes 2,000 years. Why am I only looking at what happened in the last couple of generations, how someone interpreted that? And is it based on culture or is it based on creation? So what one of the things that we see is this effort at obscuring the truth of history. And that is what we see in the modern culture wars. We're going to obscure the truth. We're going to hide the truth. And so recently in the news, there's been a hubbub, I like to call it. And yes, my kids know I make up words all the time. There's been this whole thing about the Southern Baptist Church. Now, I'm not Southern Baptist, although I was raised Baptist, but in New York. So not really my thing. My dad ordained women. But it's fascinating in the South to see the effects, the lasting effects of the denomination that split because of slavery, like culture or creation. The Southern Baptist Church as a denomination split over slavery in the 19th century. So it's been in the news, but what's interesting is this. The SBC has staked its flag on being oppositional to American culture just for the sake of opposing it as their way of being conservative. So what if you look up at the dictionary, and I encourage you to do this right now, stop, pause, look up the dictionary definition for conservative. Okay, unpause. The SBC has staked its flag in being oppositional to American culture just for the sake of opposing it as their way of being conservative. Okay, but what is the cost to the witness of Jesus, the witness for Jesus? What is the cost to discipleship and evangelism by picking that fight? And I'm only picking on the SBC today because there's a general consensus in American Christian circles that the cultural fights are for equal rights or civil rights 50 years ago is and was an assault on Christianity. But that's not true. We can look at history to find that. But again, if you're hiding history, if you don't want to talk about history, if you're telling people nothing to see here, we're not going to study racism, we're not going to study patriarchy, we're not going to look at what happened before. So I came across this recent article, because there's a bunch of articles written by Beth Barr right now because she's got a new book out and a lot of people are talking about it. It's created quite a buzz. In this article that I came across, it talked about this. About this history. And so let me back up a moment to frame what's going on. Last weekend, and right now as I'm speaking, it is May 21st. Last weekend, or maybe it was the weekend before, I don't know, Mother's Day weekend, a large Southern Baptist congregation that most of us probably didn't realize was Southern Baptist, because most Southern Baptists don't tell you they're Southern Baptists anymore. They took Baptist out their names. It's part of their marketing. And so they ordained three women. Well, according to the rules in the Southern Baptist denomination, you can't ordain women. You can have women do a lot of other things, but ordination's not one of them. So this created a big news media thing in... Actually, it extended even beyond just the Christian media, and some mainstream outlets talked about it, and it was a big thing on Twitter. And so there's some folks in this SBC who were very upset about this, and they're, you know, throwing rocks at this other church. Now, what's interesting is SBC can't seem to keep themselves out of the news. The leader of one of their seminaries talked recently about how they were anti-critical race theory. If you go back a few episodes, we talk about critical race theory and why that's just a silly argument. But so they went on record about that. And then there was an article I saw yesterday. Gosh, SBC just can't stop sticking their foot in their mouth. This one pastor wrote a resolution, got 50 other pastors behind him about it. And it's just, at the end of the day, it's like, where's the love? I thought this was, you know, God is love. Jesus taught us to love. We're supposed to love one another. But anyway, I'll post the links to some of those things so you can read it all the way through. But what happened is interesting. Why did the Southern Baptist world, when on the cusp of broadly accepting women in ministry, suddenly change its mind? So here's the thing that's interesting. They've only been opposing women in ministry in the Southern Baptist world for like the last 50 years. Yes, I know. Shock to the system on this one. Barry Hankins, in his 2002 study, Uneasy in Babylon, Southern Baptist Conservatives and American Culture, offers an intriguing argument about this, and he gives the historical background. But apparently, they used to, in the Southern Baptist denomination, they used to ordain women well into like the 50s, even in the 60s, and it wasn't a thing. So Barry Hankins gives the history, and Beth Barb talks about it in her article and references his book. She says, it is because cultural resistance is at the heart of SBC conservative values. Opposing women in ministry is not merely a matter of biblical authority, as SBC conservatives would like everyone to believe. He writes in his conclusion to chapter 7, on women, the culture has clearly decided in favor of egalitarianism, which provides SBC conservatives an opportunity to do what they do best, oppose the cultural mainstream in the name of biblical authority and conservative evangelicalism. And she says in an article, wait, did you catch that? The SBC flipped its stance on women in ministry, not because of the Bible, but because the conservative faction that took over the SBC in the late 1970s grounded their identity in cultural resistance. As Hankin writes in the introduction, conservative leaders came to believe that America, including the South, was in the throes of a cultural crisis that necessitated a warlike struggle against the forces that were hostile to evangelical faith. Women in ministry, at least in the Southern Baptist mind, became connected to the American crisis of the family. The only way to preserve the family, SBC leaders decided, was to oppose women's growing equality with men in leadership roles. Now, I'll post a link to the whole article so you can get it. I hope I've done it justice in just giving you a little window into what they're talking about. Just to clarify here, currently, the Southern Baptist Church as a denomination does not allow for the ordination of women. They don't even allow for women to speak to a mixed gender audience. And so that, but what the history shows us is that that was not always true. That in the late 70s, they grounded their identity in cultural resistance. And I think I mentioned this documentary before, but a great one to check out to understand some of the history behind our current cultural wars. And that includes the fight against abortion and the so-called culture war against the American family is PBS's documentary, God in America. And I think you can stream it from their site or find it on YouTube. But if you like books, then The Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby covers this same history as well. And here's why taking a look at the history of the evangelical church in America is so important. Not that we're anti-evangelical or anti-church, because there's a lot that I agree with personally with from a faith standpoint and a scriptural standpoint with evangelicalism, but rather to understand that scripturally speaking, even Jesus said there would be false teachers. His brother Jude, in his letter, starts off with, hey, I was going to write you guys a really nice, encouraging letter about how great you guys are doing with your church and faith and all that. But I realize that there have been some folks that have snuck in into your community that are telling you stuff that's not true. And so I've got to write you a different letter. That's how Jude's letter starts. It's the book right before Revelation, if you want to read. It's just one page. Or Galatians, Paul's letter to Galatia, the church at Galatia, where Paul's like, whoa, what happened to the gospel I taught you? False teachers are mentioned a bunch of times in the New Testament. So what that means to me as a, from a Bible study standpoint, is it's expected that we should be asking questions. Hey, where did you get that information? Why is that information? And just quoting one verse from 1 Timothy or one verse in 2 Corinthians or something is not sufficient, because all of the seminaries, whether they are white, black, or purple agree on the standards for hermeneutics, biblical interpretation, and that you start with not just one verse, but you start with asking the question, what was the author's original intent? It's the difference between exegesis and eisegesis. And so it's who was the author writing to? What were the cultural norms that he was writing about that influenced how he wrote what he wrote? And so the thing that's interesting is that a lot of times these rules and regulations that pop up throughout history over the course of the last 200 years, a lot of times are based not on creation, not on Genesis 1, not on dignity, not in Imago Dei, not on how God originally set everything up, but rather on a cultural response or a cultural perspective, because or a power perspective or an economic perspective. We really have to ask better questions. So if we look at the history of the religious right's stance on abortion, for example, and I'm not saying I'm for abortion. I am for a woman's right to having complete agency over her body and her right to make safe medical choices. I don't think we should police people's bodies. That's what slavery was about. When Africans were enslaved in the Americas, we did not have agency over our bodies. Someone else decided what that was. But anyway, I digress. So now, this week in the news, the Supreme Court once again has the question of abortion in front of them. But here's the thing, and I learned about this a few years ago. I was researching the kind of the history of abortion because I was genuinely curious. I was like, I want to ask a broader question. Like, what has the church's stance been? Because it seems like it's only recent that this was an issue. And in that research, I discovered that in the early church or in Roman culture, back in the Roman Empire in the first century, that it was, I don't want to say it was normal. It was something, if someone was unable to take care of their children and they had no immediate family that they could give the child to raise, then children of all ages were left at the city, outside the city walls a lot of times. And infants would have been left there to exposure. Exposure is basically, you know, they're just left there to die. I mean, it's horrible, but, you know, life was rough back then. But here's the thing that was really neat that the Christians did. The Christians, because they operated from a place of love, would go outside the city gates daily and look for babies. They'd look for children that were abandoned, and they would take them in and they'd raise them. And so in the early church historical accounts or stories that were shared in the first and second and third centuries, you read about people who were adopted, not just adopted into the family of God, but adopted by Christians, by people who how they interpreted and understood the gospel caused them to take action to save people. There's a lot of reasons why that, you know, why that happened. But the Christian would come along and take in these children and they'd raise them. And so unless you've got a plan that involves raising and lovingly taking care of unwanted children into your home, I really don't think you have a good logical argument against abortion, because otherwise you sound without a full picture here, you sound like you're just saying, I want to control someone's body. I'm going to tell you what you can do and what you can't do, but I'm not going to give you any resources or support to make it work out in a godly way. So again, there's a whole lot of history behind that. And then this week, the governor in Texas signed a state law that abortions would be illegal at 6 weeks in pregnancy. And I thought that was interesting because some of you who listen know me personally. And you know that, and I guess I'm admitting total space cadet on this one for myself. So, but you know, hey. So I've got four kids. Last child, who's now 10, I didn't realize I was pregnant until, like, I don't know, 10 weeks in. Like, I literally was, like, just not paying attention. And I guess after you have a few kids, you stop paying attention. But the thing is that most women aren't going to notice that they're pregnant at 6 weeks. They really aren't. And so by saying that it's illegal after 6 weeks to have an abortion, you pretty much have left people with no choice. So I digress. But I wanted to share that point because some of you may, you know, some of you might be guys and you may not realize how all that works. So the religious right took a stance against abortion, not in 1973 when Roe v. Wade was decided. No, they took a stance in 1979, 8 or 9, around that time, during the Carter administration. And, oh man, I wrote myself a note here. I meant to find the quote, the exact page number and color of compromise, where he talks about the Carter administration. Because those of you who followed Jimmy Carter know that if anybody's a follower of Jesus, it's Jimmy Carter. I mean, he teaches Bible study. He teaches Sunday school. He's really lived out a life that looks like he's trying to follow Christ. But the Republican Party decided at that time to put their eggs in the basket of another guy who was sort of kind of marginally Christian, and that was Ronald Reagan over Jimmy Carter. Now, again, I'm not trying to be political here. This is a historical fact. They put their eggs in the basket of Ronald Reagan. They did not like Jimmy Carter. Why didn't they like Jimmy Carter? Because they didn't agree with his policies politically regarding their business, their money interests. So let's back up a moment. When did schools get desegregated? Late 60s in the South, they were still desegregating schools well into the 70s. And in the 70s, you had a lot of Christian private schools that popped up all over the Deep South because folks didn't want to integrate the public schools. So they just took their kids out. But they still wanted the nonprofit tax break. But the IRS policy at the time in the late 70s had a rule about discriminatory practices. So you couldn't claim nonprofit status if you discriminated against who you let into your school. So back to abortion. That topic wasn't going to fly as a political platform for the religious right. So what they did was they got a bunch of pastors to go along with telling their congregations that it was that the Democrats were in favor of abortion and that this was bad. Mind you, nobody cared 6 years ago when all this was going through the Supreme Court. But then all of a sudden, everybody cared. Why? Because it became a political platform. And here's how it doesn't make sense and how it impacts our ability to disciple people, to evangelize folks who are outside of this religious context that cultural Christians live in. Another example, with the Texas governor signing this bill against abortion this week, he also, the very next day, signed another piece of legislation banning face masks in public schools because, and I quote here, Texans, not government, should decide their best health practices. If people can decide whether or not they want to protect small children from a pandemic, why can't these same people decide whether or not they engage in any health practice? Anyway, so we have to ask ourselves, why are some folks so bent on controlling women's bodies in the name of their religious beliefs or saving lives, but at the same time so unconcerned about keeping children safe from a deadly pandemic while they're at school? It just doesn't make any logical sense. And so that goes back to our original question of how does history impact what we understand about our beliefs, about how we are able to disciple others? Because what ends up happening is this damages our evangelism efforts in the church. And I'm so serious when I say this. Non-believers find it real hard to take Christians seriously when this sort of wackiness is what we show them. And I apologize a little bit if I'm on a soapbox about this, because this is the kind of pushback that we hear. In fact, when we were talking about the Black religious identity cults last week, as Dr. Mason was pointing out in Urban Apologetics, when we do things that are inconsistent with the gospel, when we do things that don't demonstrate the love of Jesus, when we do things that clearly impact discipleship and evangelism efforts, what we end up doing is we send people either far away from God, or we just flat out send them away from Christ and into the direction of a cult. And so from a cultural Christianity perspective, whatever your political, cultural, religious beliefs are about the abortion debate, that's not really what I'm here for. It's the historical record. The historical record shows that Christians in America are just flat out inconsistent and unreliable when it comes to the times that we jump in and out of politics and it doesn't line up with the gospel. So how do we fix that? How do we be more like Jesus? How do we follow me as I follow Christ, as Paul said? Throughout the Old Testament, the children of Israel were reminded of how God rescued them from slavery in Egypt. In the New Testament, we're reminded at the beginning of many of Paul's letters to remember the gospel that they first heard and were taught. And the gospels themselves open up with a history of God's saving grace through the genealogies of Jesus. History matters. It's not enough to base our claims for or against feminism or systemic racism or patriarchy just on the last 50 years. We have to look deeper. Our scriptures are older than 50 years, so why not look there first? And the historical access is evident in Beth Barr's book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, because she is actually a medieval literature professor. Her research wheelhouse predates the Americanized Jesus. With that, she's able to paint a picture throughout the book that is historically accurate, that goes back and looks at the cultural versus creation influence. In fact, one of my favorite bloggers, and I believe she's in New Zealand or Australia, Marge Moscow, talks about Beth Barr's new book this way. She says, in chapter 2 of her book, Beth writes about the Apostle Paul and argues that the concept of biblical womanhood, popular in some churches today, doesn't come from him. It doesn't come from Paul. Paul didn't make that up, but that's what we do. That's what we tell people. For example, after mentioning women ministers who Paul commends in Romans chapter 16, Beth writes, the historical problem with women in leadership wasn't Paul. The problem was with how we misunderstood and obscured Paul. So we'll cover all of that in a future episode, because looking back at and continuing to read Urban Apologetics, like I said, I'm walking through this with you. Chapter 9 is titled Black Women and the Appeal of the Black Conscious Community and Feminism. That's in Urban Apologetics. And so I think I mentioned before that it is Dr. Mason wrote probably most of it, but he has essays and chapters written by different people in there. And so as we look at the way that Paul is really not responsible for biblical womanhood, the way that we understand it, that we have been I don't want to say we've been misreading it. It has been obscured. I think we're reading it, but we're not taking it out of context. We're cherry picking. And so I think that has created some of the problems that we see in the last 50 years when people look back and say, well, it's feminism, it's women asking for rights. But nobody had a problem with women working when we needed Rosie the Riveter during World War II. But then all of a sudden, when the men came back from World War II, now, you know, women's places in the home. The absurdity knows no limits. And so we'll talk about that in a future episode, because I could literally spend hours talking about history. It's my favorite thing in the whole world. But our two books that we've been talking about so far, three books really, Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and Urban Apologetics, I think give us a great starting point for addressing some of the challenges in context that allow systemic racism to thrive, that allow Christian nationalism to thrive in our communities and even in our churches. So more on that topic, because I do spend a lot of time talking about historical Christianity in episode 4 of season 1 and American civil religion in episode 5 of season 1. Because I think it's really important to understand, again, Christianity doesn't begin in the 1700s. That's why folks are upset with the 1619 Project, because what they don't want to address how the folks that first came, what was really going on in 1619 in Jamestown. I'm not going to take time to talk about that right now. Because, here's the thing, and this is why I started this podcast. No more silos. We have all these silos of information that we learn things in a compartmentalized way. But what we've realized in this past year, because of the pandemic, because of the lockdowns, is that there's a desperate need for putting context to Scripture, a desperate need for a better hermeneutic, a desperate need for really understanding how the consistency of the gospel has managed to remain intact for 2,000 years. But we, as followers of Jesus, manage to at the same time be inconsistent in culture and how we share the gospel. And I think that as we peel away the cultural influences of patriarchy and racism, we'll get a better view of the gospel, and we'll be able to share that view, and we'll be able to walk in that view. And we'll continue to dig deeper into the silos of history that have been created over the years in future episodes. One of the things that I know that I want to look at in a future episode is the hashtag Leave Loud movement that's happening right now, and discuss some of the reasons that people of color choose to remain in hostile or toxic church environments. I think cultural Christianity is a big part of that. And so is proximity to power and resources. So I think it's worth exploring further. But I think another big factor is relationships. The relationships we might think we have that we're unwilling to leave or make adjustments. Often in Bible study, I talk about how the cross is symbolic in so many ways. The cross is symbolic up and down because vertically because of our relationship that's reconciled through Christ with God, so that we can get back to that initial dignity that we were made in God's image, right? But then there's also the horizontal bar, the horizontal part of the cross, and that is our relationship to one another. Our relationship to others. And those were what Jesus's commands were: love God, love one another, and love the other. And I put other in quotes because I think sometimes it's obscured or mushed with the one another part in English, but we're talking about the people who are not like us. But we're all made in the image of God. We're all made with that we're all made and created with dignity inherently. And so we have to operate that way. And so from a relationship standpoint, in our next episode, we're going to start talking about that a little bit and how cultural Christianity exploits those silos of relationships and what you and I can do, what we can do about it to be more effective at discipling others. And so as a preview, I'm going to encourage you to pick up another book. This time, I want you to check out Dr. Darius Daniels' book, Relational Intelligence. Darius Daniels' Relational Intelligence. We'll talk about that in our next episode as it relates to our ongoing conversation here on No More Silos about cultural Christianity and discipleship. Thank you so much for joining me. My name is Erica, here on No More Silos. It's a podcast about cultural Christianity. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Cultural Christianity and send any questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes via email to podcast@ericasantiago.com. Thank you once again for joining me, and I can't wait to, not see you, but hang out with you again in another week. Have a great, great day.